Well, now let's turn back to that story of Thomas that Adam read to us earlier. You remember it's found in John's Gospel, chapter 20. If you haven't got a Bible, don't worry too much, because I'm sure you're familiar with the story. But if you would like to have one, there are some at the back. You can get one from there. I just draw your attention to a couple of the key verses in the passage. The first is verse 25. When the other disciples told Thomas that they had seen the Lord, he declared, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, and put my finger where the nails were, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." And then verse 29. Jesus told him, that is Thomas, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." I wish I had your faith, Roy, but I don't. That's what Tom said. He'd been coming to church for a long while. In fact, I think a lot of people assumed he was a Christian. He was almost part of the chapel furniture. But he wasn't. He knew it. "I sit there in the congregation every Sunday," he said, "and I feel like some type of spiritual monstrosity. A fish out of water. I don't belong. I'm the odd one out in this sea of joyful hymn-singing believers. What do I do with my doubts, Roy? I want to have faith like you and the rest of them. I really do, but I haven't got it and I don't know how to get it." He was aptly named, wasn't he, Tom? For that was just how this other Thomas we read about here felt. If ever there was an odd man out, it was him. He'd returned to his old friends, anxious, no doubt, to commiserate with them about the death of this man Jesus, around whom they had centered their lives for 3 years. He expected to find them all mourning and grief-stricken as he was, since that dreadful Friday when those crosses had stood silhouetted against the Jerusalem sky. The world had fallen apart for Thomas. It had to be the same for them. But instead he found his friends on top of the world. Absolutely jubilant they were, bubbling over with some preposterous story about this Jesus having risen from the dead. Peter and James and John and the rest of them, they were all full of it. But to his utter dismay, Thomas found he just didn't seem to belong anymore. Coming into a church like this can feel like that for a lot of people. Maybe it feels like that for you. One of the first things I remember I noticed when I started going to church was the uncanny knack these Christians had of making you feel at home and uncomfortable both at the same time. Maybe that's how you feel. It's all a little bit unreal. You don't really belong here. All these Bibles and hymn books and things. Maybe you're one of those people who only comes to church on high days and holidays, you know, like Christmas and Easter. A lot of people like that. You feel it's right to come to church on Sundays. It's the thing decent people do. It's the thing your family always have done. But if the truth was known, you'd really feel more at home in the pub just down the road, or even at home watching the TV than you feel right now. Or maybe you've been coming to church for years. Your parents are Christians, your wife is a Christian, you come out of habit to please your family, but for you personally, it doesn't really mean much. Or maybe just like Tom, many people think you are a Christian. Maybe you teach in the family Bible school here sometimes. Maybe you've sometimes given your testimony. Maybe you hold a church office. Maybe you even kid yourself you're a Christian, but deep down in your heart, you know when you get away from the group pressure of all this Christian society, that this risen Jesus is not real to you personally. You'd like to believe, but the truth is you don't. What do you do with doubt like that? Well, let's see what Thomas did with his. First thing to notice is what he didn't do with it. He didn't deny his doubt. You notice that? There is something very commendable about this fellow's sincerity. He doesn't try to pretend. Now, many people would have done, wouldn't they? You know what it's like when someone tells a joke and you can't see it. There they all are, guffawing with laughter. And you can't see the funny side of it at all. What do? You laugh as well, don't you? You don't want to stand it. You don't want them to think you've got no sense of humour or stupid. No, you pretend. You roar along with mirth along with the rest of them. And it's possible to do something very similar in church. We want to be accepted. We want the respectability of being called a Christian. We want to be part of the fellowship. So we conform to the pattern of Christian behaviour we see around us. We learn all the choruses. We learn to sing them with every appearance of emotional engagement. We learn to pray spiritual-sounding prayers and to make pious comments at Bible studies. To all external observation, we become Christians. But unfortunately, it's all a pretense. It's all really a stereotype. It's not really us. Inwardly, we are just as much the odd man out as ever. Now, Thomas at least didn't fall into that trap. He's brave enough to admit, even when he's surrounded by Christian testimonies, that he hasn't got one. And believe me, that takes courage. He's candid. He can't turn faith on just like a tap, and he isn't about to pretend he can. This risen Jesus bit hadn't clicked with him yet, and he's honest enough to say so. Now that, I suggest to you, is something he did which was absolutely right. I don't think God is at all impressed by imitations, do you? He's the God of truth. If anything, that means he's more concerned about our integrity than we are ourselves. As David says in the Old Testament somewhere, he desires truth in the inward parts. Perhaps Tennyson was right then when he said there's more faith in honest doubt than in half the creeds. He knew how easy it is to stand up in church and recite the creed. He knew how empty it could be. Now, hypocrisy, no matter how effective it may be at deceiving other Christians, will never deceive God. And I suppose that's why we do read from Jesus that there will be those on the last day who will say to him, Lord, Lord! And he will reply, I never knew you. Now, if we are suffering from serious doubt this morning, the first thing we learn from Thomas is to be ruthlessly honest with ourselves about it. Don't try to pretend we are what we know we're not. If we're an unbeliever, be brave enough to admit it. Jesus respected that in Thomas, and he will respect it in you. But having said there was something commendable about Thomas's response to his doubt here, one has to say also there was something nevertheless inappropriate and unhelpful as well. The second thing to notice is that he tried to do a foolish thing. He tried to place a condition on his believing. See what he says? Unless I see the nail marks, unless I put my hand into his side, I will not believe. Now, this is, of course, a very common ploy by which some people try to defend their unwillingness to commit themselves to Jesus. They put up an if clause between them and faith. If God wants me to believe, let him prove himself to me, then I believe. Unless X or Y happens, no way is he going to get me. Some people ask for a miraculous sign. If God exists, well then write it in the sky. I am here, yours sincerely God. Then I'll believe it. Some people ask for an intellectual sign. Well, if God exists, demonstrate it to me logically, you know. Mathematical logic with QED at the bottom. Then I'll believe. And some people demand an emotional sign. If God exists, well, let him feel this peace and this joy and this spiritual exhilaration these Christians talk about. Then I'll believe. But common though such demands are, you know, I think they are very foolish. In fact, I think it's part of the purpose of the Apostle John in telling us this story of Thomas, to make us realize how inappropriate it is. You can't conditionalize true faith like that. It's psychologically impossible, and it's spiritually unreal. It's psychologically impossible because it's a bit like a boy saying to a girl, if you do this or that, I'll fall in love with you. It's not the way love works, is it? You can't turn love on like a tap. You can't turn faith on like a tap. Love is a gift, a mysterious gift. It's not in my power to will it, unless in some sense I've already got it. It's the same with faith. You cannot manufacture it yourself. You can drown a person's mind with philosophical arguments. You can render them speechless with amazement with miracles. You can paralyze them with emotional ecstasy. But you cannot create real faith that way. And people who say, I'll believe if God meets my conditions, therefore, are deluding themselves. It's psychologically impossible. It's also spiritually unreal. Because this faith we're talking about this morning is not like believing 2 and 2 equals 4. Or believing that water is 2 parts hydrogen, 1 part oxygen. It's not the sort of thing you can prove with maths or prove with scientific experiment. It's not amenable to that kind of demonstration. No, this kind of faith we're talking about is a divine gift. It's something God puts into our hearts. And you ask any believer, they will tell you they don't exactly know how they got it, what the mechanism was for its arrival. We read in this same Gospel of John, chapter 12, verse 37. Look it up if you've got the Bible with you, otherwise don't bother. This is what that says, John 12, 37. Though Jesus had done so many signs before them, that is, miraculous signs, yet they did not believe in him. Isn't that interesting? Though Jesus had done so many miracles before them, yet they did not believe in him. So that's the problem of the person who says, I can't believe unless, I will not believe unless. They're deluding themselves. It isn't the way it works. That's the thing in the tale of a story Jesus told once about a rich man and a poor man called Lazarus. When the rich man got to hell because of his sins, he says to Abraham in hell, please send that poor man Lazarus from heaven back to my brothers to warn them, otherwise they'll be judged like I've been judged. And Abraham replies, no. They've got the Bible like everybody else. Moses and the prophets. If they won't believe the Bible, they won't believe even if somebody rises from the dead and goes back and visits them. Jesus was convinced about that. He was convinced that miraculous signs have no power to generate real faith in anybody. That's why, you see, he always required faith as the condition for a miracle. He never yielded to the demand for miracles as a condition for faith. We never read, he did many miracles there to make them believe. We do read on occasion, he could not do many miracles there because of their unbelief. Signs confirm a faith that already exists. They don't create faith out of unbelief. You know as well as I do, there are some Christians who think you will get more genuine conversions if you fill the church with supernatural phenomena. Couldn't possibly be more misguided. You no more get real faith that way than by watching a football match every Saturday, you learn how to play football. It isn't the way it happens. Flesh and blood doesn't reveal Christ's glory to man. It's a gift from God himself to see that, to perceive it, to believe it. It's nothing to do with if clauses, conditions we lay down for God to satisfy, as if we were doing him a favor to believe in him when he fulfills our conditions. It's not the way it is. In fact, it's arrogance. Some people, confronted by my friend Tom, would have advised him when he said, well, how can I believe? I don't believe. I'd like to believe, but I can't. They'd say, well, you should try harder. Couldn't they? Try harder, like the White Queen told Alice in Wonderland. Faith is all a matter of personal decision and willpower. Just try harder. But that's nonsense too, isn't it? If a person's able to force themselves to believe something by willpower, they're not really believing it at all, are they? Every true convert to Christianity knows that they're facing up to the reality of things. They're not straining to believe things they can't really accept. I like that schoolboy definition of faith. Faith is believing what you know ain't true. Nonsense. The believer isn't straining that way. They are yielding, surrendering to things they can no longer reject. They believe because their psychological defenses have at last been broken down by the constraint of the truth. What induces faith in you and me is not my will to believe, but the compelling power of the object of my faith. It's not that by some great effort I am now able to achieve faith. It's much closer to the truth to say that by no amount of effort am I able any longer to avoid faith. That's what it's like. That's why theologians of an early generation used to talk about irresistible grace. That's why that vocabulary we sometimes use about deciding to be a Christian, I think, is frequently unhelpful. Because I suspect, it was certainly true for me, and I suspect those of you who are Christians here would say it was true for you, becoming a Christian, whilst it involves a decision, isn't really about making a decision. It's much closer to say it's about a surrender. It's a decision to give in. That's what we make. A decision to give in to the power of the truth upon our conscience. A decision to confess a faith which is already mysteriously there in our hearts. In that sense, it's not a decision, it's a surrender. For all these reasons, then, don't be so daft as to pretend that all that separates you from faith is the fulfillment of some conditional clause that has to be satisfied, some unless, some if. If, like Thomas, you're a doubter this morning, I put it to you, you had no idea, actually, what it would take to make you a believer. No idea at all. For faith isn't attained by some kind of mental calculation. And if you become a believer, I assure you of this, it will not because you, out of the benevolence of your generous heart, have decided to give God a try, because at last he's done what you said he had to do. Now, if you become a believer, it will be because God, out of the benevolence of his heart, has decided to give you a try. In fact, that's what Thomas found, wasn't it? That's the third thing I want you to notice about the story this morning. Just notice how Thomas, this odd one out, became a believer. See how Jesus instructs him through his experience in verses 26 and following. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Through the door, though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." In many respects, it isn't difficult for us to sympathize with Thomas's doubt, is it? Because clearly, his problem was, at least superficially it was, that he had missed out on something. The others had seen the risen Jesus with their own eyes. Unfortunately, he hadn't. Naturally enough, he assumes that it's the lack of that visual, objective experience of the risen Jesus that is responsible for his doubt. But I suggest to you, Jesus is saying very clearly here that it is nothing of the kind. It was not a lack of visible experience of the risen Jesus that was responsible for his doubt. That's what he's trying to get across to him. You see what happens here? Jesus offers himself to doubting Thomas for his scientific investigations, just as he had required. Here he says, "Am I a ghost? Am I a hallucination? Do your experiments, Thomas. If such doubts are what's bothering you, come on." But suddenly, all Thomas's conditional clauses seem to have evaporated. They seem to have become irrelevant. The rationalist skeptic, with all his demands for empirical proof, has disappeared. In fact, you get the impression the impertinence of his unbelief has become almost a painful embarrassment to him. To think that he should have demanded a scientific investigation of the body of the risen Christ as faith's ultimatum. What insolence. Now there are no more conditions, no more questions, no more impudent probing fingers. All we hear from Thomas is, my Lord and my God. Faith has arrived. Miraculously, mysteriously, faith has arrived, and it has done so as it always does, not in a context of self-congratulation, but in a context of self-abasement and worship. My Lord and my God. See how Jesus interprets Thomas's experience to him. I think those translations are right that render the first part of verse 29 as a question. Jesus told him, is it because you have seen me that you have believed? No, Thomas, it isn't. If the Christian faith can only advance into the hearts of men and women on the basis of the kind of miraculous visitation you have just experienced, then the Christian faith is going to go nowhere. No, Thomas. What you've got to realize is that true faith does not hinge on this kind of experience. True faith is a response generated not by visible signs, but by the invisible operation of God's own Spirit. It is his special work inwardly to confirm the testimony of those who are eyewitnesses of Jesus' resurrection glory to our hearts, so that we, even though we have not personally seen him, nevertheless find we can say, I believe. We may not demand then to see the risen Jesus for ourselves. It must be enough for those that follow that the apostles who were favored with that experience of the risen Jesus have written down their testimony. And that the Holy Spirit, the Spirit of the risen Jesus, alive and at work in the world, makes that testimony real to us. See how John goes on to comment to precisely that effect in verse 30. Jesus did many miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, many that are not recorded in this book. But why has John the Apostle written down this story of the resurrection and the many other miracles Jesus did? Why has he done it? Because he's an apostle. These are written, he says, that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. You think you've been specially blessed, Thomas, because you have seen me with your physical eyes? No, the real blessing is for those who have not seen and yet have believed. So, do you want to find faith? It can't be as elusive as you're making out, can it? Here in this book is the eyewitness testimony of those who saw Jesus risen from the dead. Are they liars? Are they madmen? No, the evidence of their testimony is sufficient. It has proven sufficient for millions. Why isn't it enough then for you? Perhaps your real problem then is not lack of evidence, but lack of blessing. This blessing Jesus is talking about when he says, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Maybe you should think of faith less as some kind of enterprise which you are trying to succeed at, and more as a gift which you are humbly seeking, a blessing. Maybe then there would be less of these ultimata and more humility in your search. Indeed, could it be that the real problem for you is not lack of faith at all? Perhaps for you, the real problem is an unwillingness to surrender to this Christ. I mean, don't misunderstand me, I'm not trying to make accusations, but let me ask you this. If Jesus was personally to encounter you, to make himself real to you, as maybe you long, if by the Spirit he did impress upon your heart the power of his risen person, if he did make spiritual things true in your heart's experience, would you then fall at his feet and call him Lord and God? Would you yield to his mastery? Would you give him your life? For faith is a blessing, you see. It is a gift. And it is a gift which God does not prostitute on the idly curious or the obstinately proud. He only bestows it upon those who are willing to surrender to him as Lord. I thank thee, Jesus prayed on one occasion, that thou hast hidden these things from the wise and the understanding and revealed them to babes. Yes, Father, such was thy gracious will. Or could it be, is it just possible, that this faith that you complain you lack, which you find so elusive, could it be that that faith actually is already there? Like some little inextinguishable pilot light burning in your heart, waiting for the main jet to be switched on. Perhaps that's why you're here and not down at the pub. Well, you know you'd rather be. Maybe that's why you keep coming back to church and to the Bible, because like a magnet, the Spirit of Jesus Christ within you keeps on drawing you back to him. Could that be what it is? Could it be that deep down in your heart you know this Jesus is real, but you are suppressing that truth, consciously or maybe even subconsciously, because deep down you don't want it to be true. You know it will cost you too much. You know its implications are too demanding. Could it be that it is not lack of signs, lack of evidence, not even lack of faith that obstructs your spiritual pilgrimage at all? Could it be a simple rebellion? Simple sin? Simple unwillingness to surrender your moral will to the one who is your Lord and God? Is that why you feel you don't fit? Whatever the reason, just maybe this story of Thomas is saying to you this morning that it is time you stopped complaining, time you stopped whinging about your doubts and started surrendering to your faith. Maybe it's time you passed from the agony of all those questions you can't answer to the challenge of the truth that you know deep down you cannot escape. What a relief it will be for one who has been the odd one out for so long to give in at last to this gracious Jesus who offers himself to us, to come out from behind our self-deception and our excuses. Can't you hear him speaking to you? Even as he spoke so personally to Thomas, singling him out in that congregation, that Easter congregation. No, Thomas, he said to him, you did not see my risen body. Others saw it and bore their unique testimony to it, and it should have been enough for you. He says similarly to us. Even if we could have been there in the upper room with these disciples, even if we could see before our eyes now the risen Jesus with the nail prints in his hand, it would not communicate a stronger persuasion of the truth of the Christian gospel to us than we can enjoy this morning as the Holy Spirit of this risen Jesus witnesses to the truth of the apostles' testimony to these things in the gospel. That it may seem strange, but that is what Jesus says is the psychological and spiritual truth of these things. Because you have seen me, you have believed. No. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Let's pray together.